Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to the In Doubt Show. I'm glad that you guys are tuning in, that you're joining us for today's program. We are leading up to Easter. It is Holy Week as we air this. And so we're going to talk about the significance of the resurrection and evidence of the resurrection. Some people believe that Jesus died, but the resurrection, people are a little bit iffy with it. So we're going to talk to George Sinclair shortly and just unpack all things about the resurrection and the key evidences, some of the major ones. There's obviously a lot of evidences of the resurrection. But before we dive into the conversation, if you could like, subscribe, hit the notification, that would be very helpful, so you can just stay in touch with us so that when we release new content, you're aware of it and that you can get access to it. And so we want to just resource you with truth, with hope, with life. We want to get tough questions that a lot of believers are struggling with, or people in general are struggling with, and just get biblical answers to help us navigate today's world. And so we hope you tune in. We hope this is a great resource for you. Also, if you want to become an In-Doubt Insider, you become a monthly partner. It could be $5, $10, $20, whatever you feel led to give. You'd get 20% off the store, which would get this fantastic mug. There's t-shirts. Actually, I'm wearing one right now. Sweaters, a whole bunch of stuff, books, etc. So you can get 20% off the store and a lot of fun behind-the-scenes stuff that we'll be sending out to our insiders, and some exclusive questions we ask our guests, a whole bunch of fun stuff that we're putting together for In-Doubt Insiders. That's all I got to say. Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah,
you know
Holy
what?
Week.
It's Holy Week, which is awesome, and lots to reflect on, lots to celebrate. And comment below, does your church, this is a question, does your church celebrate Holy Saturday? Comment below, I'd actually like to hear, does your church, Chris, celebrate Holy Saturday, or is it just Friday and Sunday?
Yeah, just Friday and Sunday,
yeah.
Typically. It's weird because we go to the Saturday evening services, so Easter the last few years since we've been starting to do that.
So would you do Resurrection Sunday on Saturday? Is the service the same, or is Sunday...
Actually, I think they... How did they do it? No, last year they... They did it as if it was
Sunday,
as if it was Sunday morning,
right?
But
for the Saturday crap,
yeah,
that's interesting. My old church would have a Good Friday service, would have a Holy Saturday service, kind of like the waiting,
nice,
and the preparing, and the mourning, like that awkward in between,
yeah.
And I always really appreciated that. Kind of gets you to, you know, jump into the story and feel it more. So comment below. I'm curious if your church does that. That's, you know, not a lot of churches I've seen does a Holy Saturday service
or a Monday Thursday.
Oh, yeah.
Service, yeah.
Yeah. So we'd like to hear from you guys just out of curiosity what your churches do. And that reminds me, speaking of comment belows, we've been getting some comments and getting some feedback. So we're going to take you to a quick segment. We just got a letter.
All right, Andrew, here's some mail for you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mailman.
Bippity boppity.
Have a good day. We just got a comment.
We just got a comment. We just got a comment. We just got a comment. I wonder what it says.
Guys, God bless you, but you butchered this. This is a train wreck. It's a dumpster fire. Sadly, this is what I was expecting.
Wow, thank you so much for your feedback. That was very encouraging, actually. I love dumpster fires. There's so much light. Anyways, keep writing your comments. We love to hear from you. We have a fantastic guest in third chair. So when you hear this music, Audio World.
It's Ginny of the Land.
Oh, I love it. You know him, you love him. The man, the myth, the legend with 200 voices. Marcus Miller, how you doing, buddy?
Doing well. Happy to be here.
You should do name tags of all the people. Like, you know, don't just put Marcus Miller right off the bat.
Hi, it's Christopher Walken here.
Hey, it's Patrick Warburton.
Hello, I am C-3PO, human cyborg relations.
What a gift, 200 voices. I can do like two.
Me I can do more than 200.
Actually?
Yes.
We've been introing you for the last like year?
Well, I didn't want to be like
rude,
smug about it.
Okay, so can you put a number on it for us?
No.
Have you count? You haven't count. You probably lost
I count. Did. I did. I once did a count. I think
I'm very curious right now.
It was about 500 that I had actually when I went down and listed specific characters. But then there's ones that, like, if they're played by the same actor or whatever, there's like slight tweaks, and it's like, does that count as a different character?
Like, it'd be like Kronk and then him as another person and then his another person. You know, is that what you mean?
Right, yeah.
Okay. The goose goes, boys.
You could do Kronk, and then there's
what's his name from Family Guy? It's Joe. Joe. Yeah. Peter. So here's it going.
Oh.
My wife doesn't like that one, so
so we should probably stop.
Yeah,
because she's a huge fan of the program. shout out, we know you're watching. 500. So that's way more than my advertising, where I'm saying the man with 200 voices.
Well, it's better to undersell than oversell, in my opinion.
No, from now on, we're going to be saying voices. I'm going to say 600, just because I just feel like he's probably being humble too.
It's probably true.
Hey, we're talking about resurrection. We're talking about evidence of the resurrection. Terrible segue, but we're just going to go there. You know, there's a lot of biblical evidence and historical evidence of the resurrection, which is very exciting. And it gives me hope. You know, we go through hardship, we go through trials in life. But the fact that we can stand firm on the resurrection, that Jesus is alive, that he's coming back, just gives me great hope. And so as we lead up to Easter weekend, I thought it'd be a great idea to just unpack some of the evidences from George Sinclair, who's a pastor in Ottawa. I just heard today that it's actually pronounced Ottawa.
What?
Did you guys hear this?
Who told you that?
I don't want to mention the name in case I don't want to throw him under a bus.
Or you were being punked.
Comment below. That? Do you think it's Ottawa or Ottawa? Another fantastic segue, the resurrection. No, but we should jump into the conversation, because I think it's going to be pretty cool to hear that compared to us pronouncing, you know, different places in Canada, like
Ottawa or Canada,
Winkler.
There might be something exciting that we'll announce soon about Winkler.
Oh.
Okay. Anyways, Andrew. We got George on the call here. He's joining us from Ottawa. So let's dive into the conversation and let's dive into the resurrection. All right. Well, we have George St. Clair all the way in Ottawa. How are you doing today?
I am fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. We're so honored to have you with us today. For those who are watching on video form, or if you're listening to Audio World, those might not know you. Please tell us a little bit about who you are, ministry life, family life. We might hear some dogs in the background as we're just starting to record. We heard some. So tell us a little bit about all things George St. Clair.
I live in Ottawa. I am the pastor of an urban church called Church of the Messiah. We meet right in the heart of downtown Ottawa. We're about 10-minute walk from Parliament buildings, 5-minute walk from sort of the main bar area in Ottawa, very close to the University of Ottawa. I've been ordained for 100 million years and served in suburban church. And then I've served in a very, very rural, very, very, very rural church where I looked after four little congregations. But I've been in the city since 1995. And I'm also the chair of an apologetics ministry in Ottawa that's been going. This will be our 10th anniversary in the fall, called Dig and Delve Apologetics. And I don't know, I'm married. I have 9 kids.
And okay, so we have to stop you at ordained for 100 million years. So tell us about the dinosaurs real quick. No, I'm just kidding. But 9 kids.
Correct. Yes. And I've many of them are married, and I also have grandchildren. And so God has been very kind to us.
How many grandkids do you have?
I have 21 grandchildren. By the way, I married when I was 14, which is how I've been able to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That is so funny. I was going to say you had to start young.
I did. 9 kids. So
what's the oldest kid and the youngest kid? What's the range?
There's a 19-year age range between 19. Them, but I'm not going to out their ages on air. Like
yeah,
that would
of course,
be not,
yeah.
you know, fair. So,
that's amazing.
But there's a 19-year age gap between my oldest and my youngest.
Yeah, amazing. Praise God. What a blessing, man. 21 grandkids. Yeah. That is so fun. And are a lot of them in your area? Like, do you get to see them often?
Yeah. Most of them are in my area, and we do get to see them often.
Praise God. That's so fun. Awesome. Well, we're going to be talking about something very important today as we're airing this leading up to, like, on Holy Week, leading up to Good Friday, Holy Saturday and Resurrection Sunday. And so we wanted to talk about the evidence of the resurrection. You know, a lot of people might not believe in the resurrection. And so you have some key evidences, and you released an article a few years ago with the Gospel Coalition about this. And I think you've actually been on the In-Doubt program talking through some of this, but we wanted to have you back in this format. And I wanted to hear, because I didn't get to chat with you, and everyone's saying that you're such an amazing guy. I'm like, well, that's not fair. I want to talk to him. So here we are, and we get to talk about it together. So tell us, you had 10 specific evidences that you wrote about in that article about the resurrection. And so maybe tell us those 10, and then maybe we can go through some questions together and dive deeper.
Okay. I mean, I'd have to look. By the way, there was more. I just wanted to try to keep it to 10. I need to check. I don't remember them off by heart. I don't know, getting old or something like that. I mean, the first is the fact that there are four ancient biographies of Jesus. Actually, one of the important things that one of the mistakes that people make is they the Bible's treated as a holy book. And by the way, I think it should be, but it's treated as a holy book. You take the pages, and they're the weird thin pages you don't get in any other book, and maybe some gold leaf. And what people forget is that it didn't start out like that. That when you look at the New Testament, what you actually are looking at is a combination of four eyewitness-based biographies. You're looking at a one eyewitness-based history, and all five of those books were written when many of the eyewitnesses would still have been alive. And then you're looking at a series of letters, basically theological treaties or a sermon, depending on how you want to understand the book of what we now call the book of Hebrews. And then this very odd, apocryphal, people who really love fantasy and love abstract art would love the book of Revelation. It's this very odd type of book. But that's how they all started out. They didn't start out as some type of, they didn't start out as the Bible. They started out as just four eyewitness biographies, based biographies written when Jesus, when people were still alive. They're written in, they're not written in once upon a time language. They're not written in a timeless type of language. They're written in this happened and then this happened and then this happened. He said this. And one of the astounding things about all five of those books in particular, the four biographies and the one history, is that there's constant historical references. In them, which is not what you want to do. Like if you wanted to create a fake news story today, you try to make it, you know, as generic as possible and not very specific about details. But these ancient biographies, they're very, very clear in the details. And they are, there's no particular reason to believe that any of them were written after the year 70, which means that most of them, they're all written while there were still many eyewitnesses around. That's sort of the first, you know, bit of evidence that you have letters from very close to the time of Jesus's death and resurrection, where they're talking about the death and resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you want me to keep going through all 10, or do you want to just pop in there and ask questions?
Yeah,
or what do you want to do?
We can go through each one and then maybe we can have some dialogue within each question. Like, so what do you say to some people, you know, who say, okay, well, how do you even tell that those letters are credible?
I guess the first thing I'd say, well, what exactly do you mean by credible? And so basically when you talk to some scholars and others with people with PhDs and, you know, they speak 53 languages and all that type of stuff, generally speaking, they come to, when they say that the New Testament documents aren't credible, they're saying that because they contain miracles. And actually in many cases, there's a bit of a circular argument. These can't be historical documents because they talk about the resurrection of Jesus or Jesus doing miracles. So therefore, they have to have been written some longer time afterwards. But I studied in a liberal seminary. I didn't go to an evangelical seminary. I have an undergraduate degree in sociology and with a minor in philosophy. I did graduate work in sociology at a secular university. I did a year of theology and then counseling, all in a very, 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 very ultra-liberal school. So that, I mean, the guy who taught me New Testament when I was at the ultra-liberal school, or the Christology course, actually, he actually said to the whole class that nothing in the New Testament actually happened.
What?
Now, I'm not making that up, by the way.
Wow.
But you see, the reason they say that, it's not because they have good historical evidence or anything like that. They say that because there's miracles in them. And they say, well, we know that miracles don't happen. Well, you know, partly, if you go and push them and they say, well, there's no evidence for miracles, you say, well, all of the evidence for miracles, you say, can't count as evidence because they have a miracle. Like, that's actually not a very intelligent argument. I'd probably be more polite if I was saying that, you know, to them. But, well, maybe I wouldn't be. But, you know, they say they're not credible for that type of reason. They'll have, maybe people have heard, I loved how Joe Rogan put it, it's a translation of a translation of a translation of a translation, so why on earth would you trust it? Not realizing it's not a translation of a translation of a translation, right? It's they copied the document from Greek into Greek into Greek into Greek. Eventually they did translate it into Latin, but then the Latin was translated into Latin, et cetera, Syriac, the same type of thing. And it's a matter of going back and finding the earliest, you know, documents. So it's primarily because the text claims to be very authoritative and that the text does contain miracles that people will say that it's not credible. But, well, let's have a conversation about that. You can't say something's incredible just because it has miracles unless you know that miracles don't happen. But at the heart of Christianity is the belief that miracles, in fact, happen, that God does those things.
Why would they have, just unpack that a little bit. I've heard of the, you know, argument in the theology, okay, miracles happened back then, but they don't happen anymore. But
well,
how could they say,
that's not true.
Yeah, I know that's not true, but I've heard people say that. But how could, you know, this teacher say, well, miracles didn't even happen back then?
Well, he was fundamentally committed to I would say that he had sort of a very left-wing view of Christianity as a vehicle to affect social change and a bit of a mystical view. And it was therefore none of those things depended upon the New Testament actually being true or Jesus actually having risen from the dead. He actually said literally that if they found the bones of Jesus tomorrow and you could prove that these were the bones of Jesus, he would still believe in the resurrection. Now, that came because I was pushing him and challenging him in class, by the way, which made me immensely popular. But generally speaking, you see, the scholars, that the average person who might say, well, you know, this scholar says that and that, and they don't push them to hear that there's this very, very, very major difference in worldview, so to speak, and understanding, which is at the very heart of the difference between Christianity and those who are outside of the Christian faith. It's at the very heart, but they don't tell you that they have those assumptions.
Wow. That's really fascinating. I didn't realize like there's camps like that that would go so far that direction, but I guess that makes sense.
And, you know, if you look at it very carefully, the arguments for the late dates, and I know that very many evangelical scholars will accept some of the later dates, that a lot of evangelical scholars wouldn't accept my belief that the five, you know, for instance, the four eyewitness biographies and Acts were written before the year 70. But their arguments aren't very, like, there's really no evidence for it. And I can tell you that having studied under liberals, like if you push them on it, in fact, actually it's really funny because if you said, well, you know, what's your evidence for it being late? You know, do you have letters? Do you have some letters of somebody saying that it, you know, when it was written or something like that? And the fact is they don't have any letters. They don't have any journal entries. And the only letters that they do have are letters like from Paul, which would support the resurrection of Jesus. Yeah. And in fact, it's obvious that Paul knew some of what Jesus was talking about, as well as the other letter writers in the New Testament. So they actually don't have what we would call evidence. They might have they have different maybe theories of how organizations or religious beliefs develop. But those are just like, frankly, that's just an academic version of fantasy football leagues and, you know, trying to have a bit, you know, there's actually not what anybody would really call evidence in a real world type of way. And the reason I say they're all written before 70 is, as maybe people don't know this, but Jerusalem was destroyed. The temple was destroyed in the year 70. And there's no reference to this at all in the New Testament, like zero reference to it. And given that, you know, Christians could easily maybe think that, you know, that it would be judged because of it, or Jesus's teachings about being the new way to God. You'd really think they'd say, look at this, like, you know, you Jewish people, Jesus loves you. He wants you to come to him, and you don't even have a temple to go to. And there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
And that's a huge disruption in Jewish life. Anyway,
that's fascinating.
We could keep talking about it if you want.
That's so. Very, very, very fascinating. So, I mean, clearly, you know, the credibility of the resurrection, seeing the four gospel accounts, these eyewitness accounts, and the book of Acts. You also mentioned the significance of, you know, the empty tomb and the neatly folded grave clothes. How are those significant pieces of evidence, specifically in the historical context with the grave clothes all folded up and everything all neat and tidy? Is there, like, what's the significance of that?
So, okay, I mean, the significance of this is really gross and gag-inducing, okay?
Oh, boy.
They didn't worry about germs and stuff like that back then like we would. So the fact is, the record is that the people who, in a sense, embalmed or covered the... What they do is to help cover the stench. If you're well off, they cover the body in spices, and then they wrap, and then they're putting the spices in and wrapping, and spices and wrapping it in, and that gives the body the shroud, and then they have a separate piece for the head piece because they just the way they did it, and once again, spices all there, and the spices. It was a very rich man who buried Jesus. He's buried in a rich man's tomb, and those spices would have been worth, like in our day, tens and tens of thousands of dollars. Mm. It was a very, very outrageously generous thing. And so it was a problem in the ancient world. They would see the guy buying tens and tens of thousands of dollars of spices. They would see where the person is buried. And then they would come and they would steal the body. And you'd just take the whole body. And then, you know, be like you and me deciding we're going to rob one of those cash machines. We don't want to try to disentangle it right there while the police come. You just rip the whole thing out of the building. You know, we go to your garage, and in the comfort of your garage, you get all the cash out of it. Well, they're going to do the same thing with the body. They don't care about the body. They're just looking for the spices. And so they would take it away as quickly as they could, and then they would, you know, take away the spices and then just, you know, whatever, throw the body away. They don't care about the body. So the fact that the body, the grave clothes were left behind means that it's not a grave robber. The other thing is a bit technical, but some of the language implies that it wasn't as if the body was unwrapped. The way, let's say, I don't know how old your kids are. Maybe in a couple of years, God blesses you with seven little rugrats, and they get old enough that they decide to wrap you up in a shroud. And the way you would get out of it is eventually by rolling around and getting out of it, and then, you know, chasing them if they haven't become way bigger than you, and they can throw you in the pool or whatever. But once again, that's not what's described. It's as if the body merely, Star Trek, it just got beamed out of it and left the clothes behind, and they settled. So those are important little details that are all very, you see, one of the things about all of these documents is they're not once upon a time language. They're not just, in a place, in an empire long ago, far away, but with even then no details. Everything is very concrete. There is the claim of the resurrection, and these small little details are all completely consistent with the idea that, and by the way, nobody, very, very, very few, and they're like, nobody doubts that Jesus died by crucifixion. I mean, really, it's Muslims primarily, but they only do that because of the Quran, written 600 years later. Everybody acknowledges that Jesus died. There's Jewish and other pagan philosophers and historians that acknowledge that that was the claim. There's no real denying of it. And so in all of these cases, it's not just a matter of the evidence for it. It's what better explanations are there for a whole range of facts? Like, what else accounts for the growth of the Christian movement, where all of the historical evidence is right from the get-go, as we now say, that this man Jesus died. You all saw him die. In fact, it's really interesting because even the way he dies is very public. It's not that he went up in a mountain and he died and he was buried, and then we saw him 3 days later, and they go, like, really? Like, Like, who saw that? No, they, I mean, Romans picked public spots for crucifixion because the it was meant to be a message to others. They didn't do it like quietly in a, or just surrounded by the soldiers. They picked the most public places they possibly could to crucify criminals. And in the history of the Roman Empire, there's only one alleged time that maybe somebody survived a crucifixion. And the Romans were experts at crucifixion. And so it was a very, very public death. And it was not only that, it wasn't even done like when there's a huge deep freeze or when everybody's left because there's sickness. It's done at one of the high holy times when there's the city's 15 times bigger than its usual population and there's more soldiers on duty to make sure that there's not going to be any type of rebellion. Mm-hmm. And so his death is extremely public.
Yeah,
everybody in town would have known where the grave was. And the grave is empty. They never found the body. And how do you account for the fact then that they're proclaiming that he'd actually physically raised from the dead? And despite the fact that Jewish people in those at that time had two reasons why they didn't believe resurrections would happen. One was just the same one that we have. Dead people don't rise. And once again, the historical evidence shows that not a single one of Jesus's followers or his family thought he was going to rise from the dead. They all believed he was dead. Mm. And the other thing is that the Jewish people believed that there would, some of them did believe that there'd be a resurrection, but when there was a resurrection, everybody would be resurrected. So if you went to a devout Jew and said, by the way, Jesus just rose from the dead, people saw him alive. The resurrection of Jesus just happened. Like it happened like 3 weeks ago. And that devout Jew would say, first of all, we know that dead people don't become alive again. And second, then if that's the case, why did my beloved Sarah just die yesterday? And she's not back to life. So they actually have a double reason to disbelieve it. Mm. Yet, right where this happened, there is an explosion. Thousands and thousands of people become Christians.
Yeah.
Like, so what's a better explanation of that? Like, other people have to give a good explanation of that.
Yep. And even if you think, like, you know, going on to this big explosion of Christianity and, you know, all the persecution that a lot of believers were going through, obviously they wouldn't go through that persecution if they didn't believe. Like, why would you put yourself through that? So that must be another evidence.
Yes, it would. In fact, that's actually one of the things I think I said. One of my points is, people, we all know that people die for movements. I mean, right now the Hamas war is going on and people are dying for a movement. But they, you know, they don't die for a movement. They die for a fact.
Yeah.
Like another thing which I didn't mention in that is, how do you explain Paul? And, you know, even the story of Paul is a very significant one. If you go to a Jewish rabbi today, he will know who Gamaliel is. Gamaliel is a well-known, historic, famous rabbi. And Paul isn't just a student of some nameless rabbi. He's a student of a famous rabbi. And he persecutes and is responsible for the death of the first Christian martyr. And he's on his way to Damascus. And one of the things, one of the things as well, which is really interesting when you look at all of these books as a whole, is that like Luke understands the difference between a vision and a resurrection. And he understands the difference between a resuscitation and a resurrection, just like we do. Mm-hmm. And he shows it in his literature. He has people having visions, but he says what happens to Paul isn't a vision. Mm-hmm. That Jesus was there. He has somebody be what we would now call resuscitated miraculously. But so he understands these very, very basic decisions that we understand. You know, just because they didn't have flush toilets and iPhones doesn't mean we're stupid. Mm-hmm. That's a cultural prejudice that we have. So he understands the difference. And what explains Paul completely turning around in his entire life? And once again, there's lots of good historical evidence that a guy like Paul existed. There's good historical evidence that he died by crucifixion. And he could have saved his death by merely saying, sorry, guys, joke's on you. He really didn't. I didn't see him alive. Like, he could have just stopped all of that. And it wasn't as if, I don't know, like some modern part of the Bible Belt that he could pretend this and become the pastor of a mega church and become very, very rich or anything like that. All he's going to get is beaten.
Yeah,
he loses his status, and he could have changed. And that was all over a fact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually gets like demoted. So it's like
he gets way demoted.
You got to have.
He gets canceled.
Reason. Yeah, he gets canceled. There was cancel culture back then. Yep. And so it wasn't worth it if this was all a sham to be canceled and to lose your status.
Christianity was an illegal religion. It wasn't made. It wasn't big. And that's so that people don't realize that there's no social benefit to becoming a Christian until many centuries later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating. So we have obviously these gospel eyewitness accounts. We have the grave clothes neatly folded, which is a fascinating thought just to think about that. And this idea that, you know, if it was grave robbers, they would have just taken the body and everything. But everything being folded and neatly clearly was not. And my kids have not wrapped me up yet. But I know that it would not be as gracious in coming out of it. So that's a very interesting point. Obviously the eyewitnesses and the fact that many people were persecuted and demoted and lost their status. You wouldn't just do that for a story that's made up. These are actually seeing things happen in the moment, which is amazing. And so what about Jesus? You know, Jesus predicts his own death and shares it with his disciples. And there's so many prophecies throughout the Old Testament. That has to obviously be another big point that maybe you talk about.
Yeah, so once again, you look at the historical evidence, which is those ancient letters written when eyewitnesses were still alive, and those other, you know, what we now call these four ancient biographies and the ancient history of the first 30-ish years of the Jesus movement. That's probably how I would describe what the Book of Acts was intended to be. So you look at all of those types of things, and you see that the evidence is, and by the way, it's recorded in other historians that Jesus died of crucifixion. Mm-hmm. Dying of crucifixion is not an obvious thing that you would want to do, since it was viewed as extremely shameful in Roman culture, was the death of slaves. So it wasn't something that would endear the Christian movement to the Roman pagan world. It would be a sign of defeat. Mm-hmm. And of deep shame. And of course, interestingly enough, long before crucifixion had even been invented as a punishment, the Jewish law basically describes that anybody who's crucified, who dies by hanging on a tree, is cursed. Mm-hmm. And the Jewish authorities can't have somebody crucified. It's sort of very interesting. There's sort of an extra legal killing or passionate killing of Stephen that happens early on in the Book of Acts. And that would be probably one of those things where they could say, whoa, we didn't mean it. Well, you know, sort of with a wink, right? And but he's stoned for crucifixion. That requires Rome to do it. And Jesus predicted that he would die by crucifixion, and he dies by crucifixion. Once again, that's a very, very hard thing to organize yourself.
Yeah.
And that's a thing that you wouldn't want to organize yourself, actually, if you want to endear yourself to Jewish or Roman culture. You know, maybe being stoned could have been seen as something tragic or something like that, or dying rescuing somebody or something like that, not so completely and utterly helpless as he appears to be in the crucifixion.
It's fascinating how everything is just so backwards that, you know, you can't make, like, you know, like you're talking about crucifixion, like it's not a good way to go. It's a shameful, like, all the things are opposite of what you'd think would bring success to a movement. To a movement, yeah.
Yes.
So and that's just another evidence in itself. Like, these things shouldn't add up to this huge movement and these believers.
Like, if you think about how Islam spread because Muhammad was a very successful warrior. Mm. He was a successful robber of caravans, and then he was a successful warrior, and he launched a successful warrior movement. Islam enters Europe with armed forces. Acts 16 requires Christianity entering Europe, and it's this two or three dudes met at a dock. That's when Paul arrives in Philippi. And then, you know, Buddha is teaching a way towards some type of enlightenment or therapy, and you can see how something like that would grow. Jesus is teaching something very, very different, and it's all based on historical things actually having happened, but within a wider context. So it's not merely historical curiosity, but it's history grounding our deepest longings and yearnings, history in the context of great wisdom and insight.
Absolutely. And walk us through some of the, because Jesus, you know, there's a lot of prophecies that come to pass through Jesus's life and death and resurrection that we see in the Old Testament. Can you walk us through some of the big, you know, passages that are in the Old Testament that point to the Messiah?
Yeah, the simplest two. We'll just do two.
Sure.
That's a bit of a more detailed type of thing where you look at the text.
Yeah.
Actually, basically what it is, for people to understand, here's a small little things. I think you guys are filming, you're in BC, right?
Yeah.
Right. And so you guys would know better than I would, and people who are watching this and listening to this near the Rockies know that you can, you know, when I'm there, I can be looking, like if I'm at Kitsilano or something, and I'm looking out and I can see the mountains off to, I guess, would be the north from where I am. But I might actually think there's just one group of mountains, but it might be three mountain ranges or two mountain ranges, but you can't tell from that vantage point. So one of the interesting things about the Old Testament prophecies is it wasn't until Jesus came that people then started to realize, oh, we thought there was just one mountain range, but there's actually two mountain ranges or even several mountain ranges. And that's when you then go back and you look at it and you'll see that the same prophecy is the prophecy of a virgin birth, you know, for instance, and all. But the two most obvious ones, you cannot read Psalm 22 and not see that it's referring to the crucifixion of Jesus. It's very, very patently obvious. And you cannot read the fourth servant song in Isaiah. That's Isaiah 52, verse 13 to the end of chapter 53. You cannot read that and not see that it's referring to Jesus. It's just very, very obvious. Then you'd have to go through all little bits and pieces, you know, as well of different psalms that that clearly are pointing to something happening in the future and that fit with what happened with Jesus. But, you know, just for a very casual one, the Psalm 22 written 1,000 years before Jesus, Isaiah 53 written, I don't know, 700 years before Jesus, like many, many centuries.
Yeah. Do you have your Bible with you? Could you walk us through Psalm 22? I know Isaiah 53 has so much detail, and it's like, yeah, like you said, you can't help but read it and think, oh my goodness, this is like, there's so many details in that book that point to Christ. Could you read us Psalm 22? Maybe that one's not as familiar to some people.
Yeah, sure. So it begins by the line, my God, why have you forsaken me? Another dog's want to get barking into this, so we might have to redo this. Or the listeners just have to realize,
you know what?
I have two dogs, and they like to bark at other dogs sometimes.
Yeah. It's all
actually,
good,
I have
man.
Three dogs. I love my wife, and my wife loves dogs, therefore I have dogs. So, but you have, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is how the psalm begins, which Jesus says from the cross. Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest. Yet you are enthroned as the Holy One. You are the Holy, you are the one Israel praises. In you, our ancestors put their trust. They trusted and you delivered them. To you they cried out and were saved. And you they trusted and were not put to shame. Now here we get back into the bit more of the prophecy. But I am a worm and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. These, if you go back and read the ancient evidences, these are exactly the things that are said to Jesus when he's on the cross. Yet you brought me out of the womb. You made me trust in you, even at my mother's breast. From birth I was cast on you. From my mother's womb you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for trouble is near, and there is no one to help. Now we get back into it a little bit. Many bulls surround me. Strong bulls of Bashan encircle me. Roaring lions that tear their prey, open their mouths wide against me. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. Crucifixion basically happens by making all of your bones go out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted within me. You generally die by crucifixion, if not by blood loss and germs and everything like that from the trauma of having been whipped. But in fact, actually, it's usually congestive heart failure that ends up killing a person. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. There's a description here, obviously, of the person who's going to die. Once again, descriptions of crucifixion. Dogs surround me. A pack of villains encircles me. They pierce my hands and my feet. Description of crucifixion. All my bones are on display, or my body is on display. People stare and gloat over me. In crucifixion, you're naked. You're publicly humiliated completely and utterly so that people can stare and gloat over you. They divide my clothes among them and cast lots for my garment. That's something that Jesus couldn't have organized, that the Roman soldiers, not Jewish people, but Roman soldiers do that. And then it goes on more about a little bit about ultimately the, I don't know if you want me to keep reading because it's 31 verses. Up to you. I'll keep reading.
Yeah,
if you
keep
want.
Going. Keep going. This is but good. Yeah.
Oh, is it okay? But you, Lord, do not be far from me. You are my strength. Come quickly to help me. Deliver me from the sword, my precious life from the power of the dogs. Rescue me from the mouth of the lions and save me from the horns of the wild oxen. Now that could be read as something which means that, in a sense, like what the Jewish high priests say, like if you really are the Son of God, why don't you come down from the cross? But it could also be seen as the fact that the deliverance comes through him, Jesus dying and tasting all there is to taste of death, and then being resurrected. And that there's even this sign that there's going to be something like that that happens to him when it continues. I will declare your name to my people. In the assembly, I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you descendants of Jacob, honor him, revere him, all you descendants of Israel. For he has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one. He has not hidden his face from him, but has listened to his cry for help. From you comes the theme of my praise in the great assembly. Before those who fear you, I will fulfill my vows. The poor will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down to him. For dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. I mean, now you can see that Christianity is all over the globe. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship, and all who go down to dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. He's even referring to himself as the Lord, and they will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. And he has done it is very similar to the final words of Jesus, which it is finished.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's one of the more clear examples, Isaiah 53. The others become a little bit more subtle. If you're reading the book of, you know, Zechariah, I can't remember. There's like 600 prophecies or something like that that Jesus fulfills. But that comes down to a little bit more detail than I could just give you off the cuff. You have to invite me back and have me prepared for it.
Part two, yeah.
In advance, yeah.
But it's fascinating because,
get John Neufeld to do it.
Yeah, come on. So the psalmist who's writing this is obviously talking about this future prophecy, but also talking about their current state. How does it work with prophecy like that?
Biblical prophecy is a combination of foretelling and foretelling, just to use a little bit of a thing. So it's sometimes it can be exclusively foretelling, where you're speaking into the situation that you live in right now. Sometimes it's almost exclusively future, but right. Usually it's a balance of the two.
Right.
So, and actually, here's a thing that's interesting is, I believe that whether it's the Bible or evidences for Christianity or evidences for the resurrection, God has given enough information that you can say it's reasonable to believe, but he's not given so much information that you'd be complete and utter fool to not believe it. There ends up always being enough and a sense of a balance there, a mixture of, this is enough to base my decision on for the rest of my life. But it's never reaches the level of 2 + 2 = 4.
Interesting.
And, anyway, I don't know.
That's very
interesting. So in terms of the prophecy and the foretelling, that you get those mixtures in it.
Yeah, and I really like that. That's where like faith comes in. If it was all 2 + 2 = 4, you know, I like that. That, you know, there's this aspect of Jesus I trust.
But it's not a leap. But it's not a leap in the dark.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's not. There are grounds to think about it.
Yeah.
To consider it. That it's a reasonable thing to consider. But it's way more than reason.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that. Okay, so, you know, we see all these prophecies. We see, as we're going through all these different evidences, can we discuss how the resurrection of Jesus fits in the broader narrative of human history and the development of societal norms, values, particularly in relation to science, human rights, governance?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really encourage people to either read the book by Tom Holland called Dominion, or go on YouTube and look for some of his talks that he's given. If you want a bit of a summary, you don't want to read a big, fat, thick book like this. But what happened is he's a well-known public intellectual in England, publishes best-selling books, completely secular, mm-hmm. And proudly secular. And he'd written a book on the historical origins of Islamic belief. And at a book signing, a Muslim man came up and said to him, "I really enjoyed the book. You should consider doing this about your own secular enlightenment beliefs." And Tom Holland thought about it on the way home and thought, you know, that's a really good idea. I don't know if anybody's ever done something like that. Hmm. So he started to do this. And to his horror, he discovered that every one of his cherished enlightenment beliefs came from Christianity. Hmm. None of them came from secular thinking, and none of them came from the pagan thinkers. Like, none of them. They all came from secular Christianity. There's a fellow by the name of Glenn Scrivener who's written a book called The Air We Breathe. And he comes up with, I think it's either, I can't remember if it's 7 or 9 different very core beliefs of the modern world. And he only uses scholars from outside of the Christian faith to show that in every one of those cases, it comes from Christianity. So, I mean, that's the first little bit about it. But so here's the bigger idea. It's not just that, like if we discover all of a sudden that Elvis had risen from the dead after 4 days, like that would just be weird. It would just be weird because there's no context for that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Right. In the case of Jesus, as we've already talked about, there's centuries of prophecies that there will be a Messiah. There is Jesus's own life and his own predictions. And the what we now call the Old Testament or the Tanakh, and combined with the New Testament, is a very, very, very powerful overarching story to explain human existence and human reality. The New Testament documents, the Old and New Testament documents have literature which has profound insight about the human psyche and human experience. If you just look at somebody like Jordan Peterson, and Jordan and I would disagree on some things. I think things in the book of Exodus and all happened. But he's very skilled at showing how these stories touch at some very, very, very deep aspects of what it means to be a human being.
Yeah.
And on top of that, it is in these older this older literature that we get the idea of human rights. We get the idea that women aren't property of men. We get the idea that women can't just be sexually accosted because they're men's property, but they have their own inherent dignity. We get a very, very high and exalted view of marriage within the whole idea of human beings having innate dignity and worth. We have the grounds for human rights. And in the entire way that the Old Testament and the New Testament describes both creation and miracles, you have the belief, you have this idea that there is an ordered God who created an ordered universe who wants his people to discover that order so that they can be fruitful and multiply. And hence you have the beginning of science. And so Jesus's death and resurrection takes place in the context of these profound transformative ideas. And so many of the most secular people in our culture don't realize that they're actually, in a sense, Christian heretics because they haven't realized that they were told by somebody who was told by somebody, and you take 50 times removed, and it ultimately comes from an Old or New Testament idea, Christian idea.
Fascinating, fascinating. So much good stuff here. We'll ask one more question, And I know the grandkids are over, so I want to make sure that you enjoy them.
And now I have my parrot making noise. So that's my wife. Well,
okay,
my,
so my parrots, wife dogs.
Could have her own zoo if she could have a zoo, by the way.
Oh, that's amazing. I love it. Okay, one last question, and then we'll let you get back to all the fun stuff happening in your house right now. For young people who are, and we're going to make sure those who are watching and listening right now, indoubt.ca, or there's a a link to the description with some of these references that we're talking about, and even the article that George has written on these evidences to help you kind of navigate. But for young people or our listeners who are watching today who are exploring their faith and are questioning religious beliefs, what advice or resources would you recommend to further their exploration of the evidence and the significance of Jesus's resurrection?
In terms of what are good resources
To help them kind of
in terms
explore.
Of the resurrection, or just to understand maybe their doubts or stuff like that? Which is the, I'm not, which is it, two questions or one?
Maybe the resurrection. Since we're focusing on the resurrection, just to help them explore and further understanding.
Well, I'll say like two things. The first one is, the simplest thing would be to go to somebody like Mike Lacona or Gary Habermas. Gary Habermas, I mean, they've written very thick books, and if you don't want to read a full thick book, Mike Lacona has had a book on how to understand, for instance, New Testament differences, all part of establishing the historical reliability of the New Testament and why you can believe the resurrection. That's published by Oxford University Press. If you just go on YouTube, you can hear Gary Habermas or Mike Lacona talk, if that's more your thing rather than reading books. They'd be the two. I mean, I'd also recommend Sean McDowell if you go hunting. He's had both Mike Lacona and Gary Habermas and William Lane Craig, who's written an important book on it as well. Peter T. Williams has written a very, very good short book on trusting the historical reliability of the New Testament, as has Richard Bachman, showing how the New Testament's based on eyewitness history. And in both cases, if you don't want to read the book, you can probably find something on YouTube. Where you hear them speaking. And the only other thing I would say to young people on a bit of a quest is Blaise Pascal in the 1600s said something very wise. He said that people outside the Christian faith will always have reasons why they think Christianity cannot be true. And that's fair enough. But what they don't realize is they also have a prior commitment that they don't want it to be true. And, if you're starting to go through a little bit of a question of your faith and separating from the faith of your parents or your church, and, maybe you should look at some other articles. There are people who will give intelligent reasons for the Christian faith. But it's important to ask yourself as well, are you trying to maybe wander away from the Christian faith because the fact of the matter is you don't want it to be true? It's not a matter of being reasonable, but you don't want it to be true. And I'll just say one other thing with that as well. Is that one of the things that the world often does is they'll throw up some scattered reasons as to why you can't believe the resurrection or something like that. But in the back of your mind, or even them saying that they have to say that unless it's like perfect evidence and can't be true, but that's virtually never true of anything in life. Mm-hmm. You never have perfect evidence. You just have good evidence, and good evidence and perfect evidence isn't the same. Mm-hmm. But so first of all, you just need to remember that is there good evidence, there's never going to be perfect evidence. And the second thing is the skeptics and others who might be trying to draw you from the faith, they show the reasons why Christianity can't be true. And then they say, therefore this, but they never actually show you why their this can withstand the same challenges. They try to get you to say, oh, okay, well, that can't be true. But then they don't interrogate at all their own belief. And I just want to challenge, listeners. Listen, if you look at it, sort of face to face, and you compare Islam and Christianity, you compare secularism and Christianity, you compare these things, Christianity is really compelling. And so if you are, make sure you look at both sides.
Yeah.
And frankly, nobody's going to look at other accounts to explain the resurrection. They look really weak. They're like really lame. In fact, they're lame. Doesn't matter. It can be lame and written by somebody with two PhDs. You can have two PhDs and be lame.
Wow.
Give me two PhDs and be brilliant.
Yeah.
But their contrary explanations aren't very, they're not very good.
Yeah. Wow.
So that would be my hope.
Yeah. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time. Thank you for your wisdom. And All the best to you. 21 grandkids, 9 kids, parrots, dogs, all that's happening in your house. Thank you for taking time to be with us today as we unpack this evidence of the resurrection. It's just such a message filled with hope and just blesses my heart to unpack this. So thank you so much for your time today.
God bless.
God bless you too. Well, that was fantastic.
That was fantastic. That was very good.
21 grandchildren, though.
Holy smokes. And a parrot.
And a parrot.
And dogs. And I swear I thought I heard a llama, but I don't know if you hit a sound bite by accident.
No, I mean,
I thought you pressed it by accident, yeah, but
no.
Well, it could be.
For part of it, I thought that it was his grandkids.
I know, because it was hard to hear it.
And then Skylar, who was listening in with me, was like, that sounded like a parrot.
So that's really interesting that Skylar could like discern a parrot.
Yeah.
Not a lot of people could just say, hey, no, that's a parrot. Can they? I was hoping the parrot would be like, evidence of the resurrection, the grave clothes, which is a fantastic segue.
That was really interesting.
Because I thought that was very interesting. And I liked how he analogized. Is that... I'm just kidding. Chris said that before we pressed record.
I did. I don't know if it's a word. I was just saying I liked how he...
If it is, placed, I wouldn't say it.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was trying not to.
Yeah, sorry. But I like the analogy he gave. About the, like, if you're going to take an ATM or whatever, yep. You'll, like, grab the whole unit and go to your garage and then...
I just like the fact that he placed himself in you doing it. I liked imagining...
And the level of detail in that analogy.
Yeah, like, the two of you were going in...
Honestly, I felt really close to him in that moment. Yeah. I felt like we were good buds.
It was kind of funny. I was picturing you guys in some garage trying
with, like, gloves and, like, you know, like, a little mask and stuff. Yeah, yeah. I pictured it too, actually.
A parrot in the background.
A parrot, yeah, it's like, hurry up! Hurry up, take the money. But I liked, I can't do a parrot as good as you.
No, that was pretty good, actually.
Thanks, man. Wait, for I'd a man like who knows over 500 voices, that's, I take that as a compliment. I just, it was the way he gave that analogy. It was like, okay, if someone was going to, you know, say, okay, the body was stolen, which a lot of people, that's one of the things that they use as the excuse of why the body wasn't there. But the expensive spices, you know, the reason for people doing it and the reason why, you know, grave robbery was like so popular, but how everything was like neatly folded, and even just how he analogized me with my kids, and if they wrapped me up, and like if I were to get
like
out,
you wouldn't be.
Oh, that tomb would be a disaster if he's rolling around everywhere trying to like get out of that. So that was just like a good way to debunk that. That thought.
And I also thought it was very interesting just mentioning the fact that there were. Still a lot of eyewitness accounts at that time, and just like the rapid growth of Christianity from the point of the resurrection, and why that there would actually be more reason for people to disbelieve at the time that there were eyewitnesses than now. Mm-hmm. Like if people were going to debunk it, they would have debunked it back then. It wouldn't have spread as big as it did that rapidly like that. If there weren't the amount of eyewitnesses that could testify to the truth.
Yeah.
That was very fascinating.
Even walking through Psalm 22, seeing all the correlations, and that's like there are tons of scriptures, you know, that go back and forth, the foreshadowing. I thought that was just really fascinating. And it's just hard to even the fact that a crucifixion would be so shameful and so, you know, humiliating, all these things. It's like, why would, you know... Everything that happened.
If you're going to make it up, why would you make it that?
But it's interesting that a lot of people, he would say, agree that he was crucified. Like a lot of people say, okay, he was a person and he did die on a cross.
Yeah.
It's, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Which kind of goes into his other point of like, there is a lot of evidence towards his resurrection.
Yeah.
So if you don't believe, is it? Because it's not there, or is it because you don't want to believe?
I thought that was fascinating.
And that was a very interesting point, because often it's... I don't know what I'm saying. I was trying to say something.
It's
something
like Michael
smart,
Scott, but, where you just keep talking, you just hope you can come around.
No,
I know what you're saying.
Like, you have to deal with the evidence of the resurrection.
If you understand that it's correct, then you have to deal with the realities of the truth. And if you can't accept the realities of the truth, if you can't handle the truth, then you are in a difficult position, my friend.
It's true. It's true. Thank you, Jack. But
anytime, Andrew, I'll be here.
It's also the face that's important, hey? Yeah.
It is the face,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not just the voice. For those of you who are right. in audio world, you're probably like, what are you even talking about? Well, head over to YouTube, and you can actually see Jack's face when he does his voice. Yeah. Even Kronk kind of looks like Kronk.
Right.
Yeah, those squinty eyes. No, you're right. And I think when people are like, oh, if they want to accept the resurrection, that means their life, everything's going to change.
Yep.
And the selfishness, the self-drive, me, myself, and I, all that's going to get messed up.
Yep.
And a lot of people don't want to believe the resurrection because that's going to literally change their life. But for the better.
Yeah, see, that understand. Was exactly what I was trying to say.
I know.
And you said it very well.
Well, you did too.
Thank you.
Jack. But did you have any major takeaways?
That was my major takeaway.
Which one? The grave clothes?
Yeah.
Well, no.
No. Yeah.
No, you made fun of me for being so obsessed with it.
Well, you, I'm just
not
saying
obsessed,
in the interview, you seemed really into it.
I was.
Which was good.
Yeah,
it was
I was.
Good, yeah.
No, that was a great conversation, and I hope that those who watched or those who tuned in audio world, that you're encouraged. Reach out to us if you have any questions. We can give you more information, more resources about the resurrection and gather more evidence and, you know, things that you would need. He mentioned a lot of books towards the end of our conversation, so I'd like to maybe make sure if you go to endout.ca, link in description, and then, yeah, there's something that's going to pop up and, you know, just right here. No. There, Marcus, make it happen. Anyways, he's like, I'll see what I can do, huh?
It's just going to be floating around wherever your hands are. It's just going to be.
So, for more information, anyways, again, audio world, you're probably like, what's going on? Anyway, head over to YouTube and you can see that we kind of are a dumpster fire, I guess, actually. I think maybe that comment was right.
I thought that was a compliment. I've been calling people dumpster fires all week. And I was wondering why they were looking at me so weird.
You're like, oh, but you illuminate. You have like this
it's
aroma.
Like you're garbage, but you're hot garbage.
You're hot garbage. You're a hot mess. I thought that was nice. Chris, you're calling everyone. No wonder why you keep texting me.
I was like, oh, good job. That's such a dumpster fire there, man.
That was like, that
I
is
assumed
hilarious.
You hated me.
Yeah, me too. Wow. Now I realize he was actually trying to compliment us. Oh, praise God. That's awesome. We'll leave some references and all those books, you know, resources that George mentioned in the website, endout.ca. And as you lead up to Holy Week, maybe some of you got our resource, Quiet Spaces. Maybe you didn't. If you didn't.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, man. Better luck next time, I guess. But we have like an 8-day kind of leading up to.
You might still be able to get it.
Yeah. Go to endout.ca, check if it's
Easter.
There. It might be sold out, you know. Yeah. Just go to endout.ca and go to the store. There's a book, Quiet Spaces, and just kind of walks through Easter. And so if you have that, keep going through it. Reflect, meditate, think of all that Christ has done for us, for me, for us, for you. And we just hope that you have an amazing Easter week as you reflect. And that's all I got to say.
He is risen indeed.
Yes. God bless you guys. We'll see you next week.